Have you ever met someone that was too good to be true, or they seemed too good to be true? In fact, the way they acted, they were so positive, they were so bright, and they were so cheery, and everything they said was nice. You began to wonder whether they were genuine. So you began, you know, our human nature just kicks in, and you begin to wonder, they can't be that way. But the good thing is sometimes you find those people that are just that way. They're not putting on airs. They're not. They're very genuine in the way that they come across. In fact, this would be a person who's not only of good character and disposition, but also a person who's very good looking. You know, as a man, they would be termed handsome. As a woman, they would be seen as beautiful. They were mentally sharp. They were right on top of every situation. They're wise in counsel. They're logical in their approach. And you know, as you describe a person like that, it almost sounds too good to be true. And the question is, does the Bible describe such a person? Interestingly, the Bible devotes a great deal of space to this person. As you look at biblical personalities, the Bible devotes 13 chapters to Abraham. It devotes only 2 to Isaac. Why only 2 to Isaac? It's because Isaac did most everything right. And so you didn't have to spend a lot of time talking about his flaws and areas where he had to learn lessons. He, in fact, was a very, very positive person. It devotes 9 or 10 chapters to Jacob. Moses wrote 5 books, and he figures prominently in a number of them. And you look at David. There's quite a bit of information written in the Bible about David, so we can learn a lot about him, as well as seeing his reflections in the Psalms. The man I'm thinking about has as much written about him as Abraham. And we're familiar with the exploits of Abraham, of Isaac, of Jacob, Moses, and David, and the apostles Peter and Paul. We can read about them in the scriptures. And interestingly, the Bible not only tells us about their good qualities, but it also tells us about their flaws so that we can see the complete person. But as you think about biblical personalities, how many of us are truly familiar with Joseph? We're truly familiar with Joseph. We know that Joseph was Jacob's favorite. We know that his brothers hated him. We know that he was sold into Egypt, that he fled from Potiphar's wife, that he was thrown into prison, that he interpreted the dreams of the baker, the butler, and the Pharaoh, that he came out of prison, that he became the second in Egypt, a very high office, second in command, really, in the nation of Egypt, and that he administered his own plan of salvation. Now, it wasn't a spiritual salvation, but it was the salvation of the world that time due to his agricultural plan. Now, that's an overview of the story, but it's just a skeleton of information that we can find about Joseph. He was used to ensure the fulfilling of a prophecy that was made to Abraham, a physical illustration of a major spiritual truth. And there is within his story expressions of character, of faith, of wisdom, of love. And we can learn a great deal about how to live by looking at his life and the experiences that he went through. Herbert Lockyer, in a book entitled All the Women of the Bible, calls Joseph the godliest and greatest of Jacob's children. And he stands out as the most perfect example of Jesus Christ in all the Bible. And others give him similar praise. The only negative criticism about him is that when he was young, he basically told his brothers that I'm going to rule over you, which was true and alienated his brothers, but it was something that God gave him an understanding of at a young age. And as you look at him and you examine him, interestingly, we don't find a lot about him passing on spiritual truths to either the people of Israel or to the Gentiles. God didn't use him in that way. But Joseph exemplified the qualities of a truly godly life, of a truly godly life. And he's the only one, as I said, that really lives up to a large extent of the standard of Jesus Christ. He was truly an outstanding individual. Now, what we're going to do today is we're going to look at some background information about Joseph. So we're going to look at Joseph, but not directly. We're going to look at some things that took place in his life that are important for us to understand in order that we can get the full impact of Joseph and the way that he lived his life. So we're going to look at some background things today. So let's go to Genesis chapter 30. Genesis chapter 30. And we'll spend quite a bit of time in the book of Genesis since that's where the story is told. But we just want to look at his birth beginning in Genesis chapter 30, verse 22. Genesis chapter 30, verse 22. Then God remembered Rachel. And God listened to her and opened her womb. And she conceived and bore a son and said, God has taken away my reproach. So she called his name Joseph. She called his name Joseph. The Lord shall add to me another son. So Genesis 30, as you look through it, and this is just the portion that talks about Joseph's birth. He was the child of Jacob and Rachel. It talks about the births of the other children that were born to Jacob. And it talks about the competition for Jacob's affections by his wives, the sisters, Rachel and Leah. Because there were many wives and concubines, the conclusions about Joseph's birth are varied. Without a doubt, he was Rachel's first son. He was the seventh son of the two wives, Rachel and Leah. He was the eighth child to the two wives because there was one daughter that was born in there. And Leah had a daughter, Dinah. And overall, considering the concubines Bilhah and Zilpah, he appears to have been the 11th child born to Jacob. So he had a pretty good-sized family, born of different mothers. And I don't think the birth order is of great significance, you know, that he was first or fourth or tenth. That's not the big issue. Except that when you look at all of the family and all of the things that go on, you have to realize that Joseph was not born into a perfect family atmosphere. Jacob himself did not live in a perfect family atmosphere. There was competition, bickering, jealousy. And as you look at Joseph and how well he turned out, that's to God's credit and Joseph's yieldedness to God that he turned out as well as he did. So, like everybody's story, his story begins before his birth with his ancestry and some of the things that they did. Joseph was descended from a long line of biblical personalities. Before him came Noah, Shem, Eber, Abraham, Isaac, and Jacob. And there were women in his background as well. Rebekah was the wife of Isaac, and Rachel was the wife of Jacob. And Abraham, interestingly, was still alive 15 years after Jacob was born. So Jacob had some interaction with his grandfather, Abraham. And Joseph undoubtedly had several years of contact with Isaac. Isaac was an old man, but he had contact with Isaac at the end of his life. Maybe for about a 10-year span, Isaac dying at the age of 180. Joseph was born in Syria, born up in the area where his uncle lived by the name of Laban. And he was born in Syria when Isaac was 150 years old. Within a few years after his birth, Jacob returned to the land of Canaan. And Joseph was then sold into slavery when he was 17 years old. So as I said, it's entirely possible that he had about a decade to spend with his grandfather, Isaac. Rachel, who was of a different branch of the same family as Jacob, she was the niece of Rebekah, who was Jacob's mother, she was in fact Jacob's cousin. Rachel's name means ewe. It means ewe and gives the indication of natural beauty of a pleasing personality. Now, that's not always the case. Sometimes your name reflects exactly who you are. Sometimes it doesn't. Let's go to Genesis chapter 29, verse 17. Genesis chapter 29, verse 17. And we're told here, Leah's eyes were delicate. And this is not an eye condition. It's how her eye, if you looked at her, you would notice her eyes were a certain way and they gave you a certain indication about who she was and the way she was. Her eyes were delicate. But and it's talking about your personal appearance, and her eyes were delicate. But Rachel was beautiful of form and appearance. So Rachel's eyes were delicate. Her eyes must have been a striking feature of her particular outward appearance. But Rachel was beautiful. She was beautiful of form and appearance. When Jacob first saw Rachel upon their meeting at the well, what did he do? What was his reaction to seeing Rachel? It says in verse 18 of chapter 29. Now Jacob loved Rachel, so he said, "I will serve you 7 years for Rachel, your younger daughter." He noticed her and he thought that she was beautiful, and he fell madly in love with her. And he loved her. And Jacob loved Rachel. And he was willing to serve 7 years for her. And you go to verse 20 and it says, so Jacob's, and that was the deal. You have to work 7 years for my daughter, Rachel. So deep was his love that it says in verse 20, Jacob served 7 years for Rachel, and they seemed only a few days to him because of the love he had for her. So he greatly loved her, and that 7 years passed, and it seemed like a very short period of time to him. So that's really a depth of love. And you know what? I know this is staggering living in 21st century America, but they were chaste that whole time. They were chaste. They never crossed the line of sexual impropriety during that time. So that's a long time to wait. And he did love Rachel. And let's go down to verse 30. Then Jacob also went into Rachel, and he also loved Rachel more than Leah. And he served with Laban still another 7 years. So we see that Jacob loved Rachel more than Leah. So if you are in a household with two wives and you love one more than the other, what's the outcome of that going to be? You know there's going to be peace. You know there's going to be harmony. That's impossible. And the women knew it. And but Jacob loved Rachel more than Leah. It wasn't a passing fancy, and Jacob loved Rachel to the end of Rachel's life. He always loved her and preferred her over Leah. So let's go to chapter 29 and look at verse 31. When the Lord saw that Leah was unloved, so not only did Jacob love Rachel more, but God noticed this. He noticed that Jacob loved Rachel more and that Leah was unloved. And God, noticing that, did bless her with children. And as you look at the situation here, you can see that Jacob loved Rachel and that Rachel had the key to Jacob's heart. But as you look at Leah, you might say that she had the keys to the house. Because as it says here, God noticed her condition and God gave her certain blessings as a result of it. The Bible attributes many of these things that occurred in the lives of these two ladies to the fact that God was directly involved. And he was involved because he had a great purpose that he's going to work out, as he's going to use the descendants of Jacob to accomplish a great part of his plan. Now, Leah was not hated in the sense that Jacob was openly hostile to her or he loathed her in some way, but rather she was loved less. In other words, she did not get a fair deal from Jacob. He did not treat her as he should have treated her. She was not given the same kind, thoughtful consideration and care and concern that Jacob gave to Rachel. Leah could always observe that, you know, it'd be kind of like there's one chair in the room and Leah's sitting in it and Rachel comes in and Jacob would say, "Hey, you need to get up and let Rachel sit here." It was that kind of thing where he preferred one over the other. But Leah loved Jacob and Leah wanted Jacob to show the same feelings that she had for him. But Jacob only showed those feelings for Rachel. And I mentioned that it seems as though Leah had the keys to the house because as you look at how things worked out, Leah was the mother of one of the sons by the name of Judah. And who descended from Judah? It is through Judah that the scepter came and that the Christ came. You also look at another son of Leah. That son was Levi, and Levi was the son his descendants received the priesthood. So as you look at Israel, two of the highest positions that were ever going to come were given to descendants of Leah. Now, the kind of favoritism that Jacob showed, I think, was quite natural. And it's something that we should expect from multiple marriages, polygamy. It played a very large role in creating the endless state of hard feelings and competition that existed in Jacob's family. And you know, as Jacob was given the opportunity to have two wives, Jacob was a conniver. Jacob was a supplanter. Jacob was an opportunist. So I'm sure that he thought, well, I want Rachel, but you're going to give me her too? Sweet. I'll have two wives. And she's pretty good looking too. So he thought he was going to get a great deal. And if you ever thought about, boy, that polygamy would be a great way to go, just read this story and reflect on it for a while. There are some very powerful lessons that you find here. Let's look at some interesting things that happened with Leah and the children that she has. And you can see the longing that she has for a relationship with Jacob in the very names that she gives to her children. Let's go to chapter 29 and look at verse 32. It says, so Leah conceived and bore a son, and she called his name Reuben. Why did she name him Reuben? For she said, the Lord has surely looked on my affliction. Now, therefore, my husband will love me. I have gotten pregnant. I have given my son, my husband, a son. Something of great value in that time. And so she said, maybe as a result of this, God's looked on my affliction and now my husband will love me. Obviously, she felt unloved. You go on and you look at verse 33. Then she conceived again and bore a son and said, because the Lord has heard that I am unloved, he has therefore given me this son also. And she called his name Simeon. Because the Lord has heard that I'm unloved. And then in verse 35, it speaks of the next son. And she conceived again and bore a son and said, now I will praise the Lord, therefore. Excuse me, wrong verse. It's verse 34. She conceived again and bore a son, and his name was Levi. And why did she name him Levi? I have borne him three sons, therefore his name was called Levi. So she's hoping that her husband would become attached to her because she had borne him three sons. But it didn't change things. Jacob and Leah were joined together in sexual intercourse, but their lives were not together. She knew full well that he was not together with her as she would have liked. She thought that each time that she had a child, things would improve, but they never did. Jacob did not extend greater affections toward her. That just didn't happen. And it was one of the challenges that she had to live with in her life. Verse 35, it says, and she conceived again and bore a son, and now I will praise the Lord. Therefore she called his name Judah. Then she stopped bearing. Now I will praise the Lord. Even here it indicates the meaning of Judah's name, which is praise, that she was ever hopeful. She was ever hopeful. She was hoping that God was showing her the blessing. She hoped that Jacob would somehow see the situation and realize that maybe she was the one that God wanted him to be with. So, this, you know, here you have these two sisters, and the Bible specifically tells you not to marry two sisters. It tells you don't do that. And this was before the law was given. But Jacob did this, and you see that Rachel is noticing that her sister is having one boy after another. And what was her response to that? Let's go to chapter 30 and look at verse 1. Now, when Rachel saw that she bore Jacob no children, Rachel envied her sister. She envied her sister and said to Jacob, give me children or else I die. She was emphatic. Give me children, or else I die. So do we see what's happening here? Leah is in anguish that she does not have the love of Jacob. And Rachel is in anguish and envy because she's not bearing children to the one that she loves. She's envious of her sister. Were these women going through this? Were they learning certain lessons? Do you think they might be able to explain to somebody in the future, I wouldn't go down the polygamy path if I were you? Why not? Let me describe my experience. Probably both of these women would be quite effective in letting other people know, don't go down this path. And really, as you see what unfolds here in this family, you'd have to be completely oblivious to miss the lessons that one can learn. And all of this conflict and envy was going to impact whom? It impacted the two women. It impacted their sons. And it most assuredly impacted Joseph. It impacted the whole family. It impacted Jacob. So Jacob probably thought, boy, what have I got myself into as he's facing some of these things? So as it says in chapter 30, verse 1, Rachel envied her sister, and in an outburst of bitter anguish over her barren condition, she makes a rather rash statement. Give me children, else I die. And what Rachel said is exactly what happened. God gave her two children. What happened while she was having the second one? What happened while she was having the second one? She died. You might think about the Ecclesiastes chapter 5, verse 2. Ecclesiastes 5, verse 2 says, do not be rash with your mouth, and let not your heart utter anything hastily before God, for God is in heaven and you on earth. So we can make rather rash statements, and God has the power to respond, even in the way that we might suggest as we're bitter and filled with anguish. He may respond, but he may just give us what we ask for. The last part of Ecclesiastes 5:2 says, therefore, let your words be few. Be careful what you say. And it's a very similar situation to Moses. There was a point where Moses was very angry and God had told him to speak to the rock. But he was so angry, what did he do? He hit the rock. He hit the rock twice. And the result was, God said, you will not enter the land of promise. You've been rash. You've become angry and acted rashly. Maybe what happened to Rachel is a coincidence. God did give her two children, but she died in giving birth to the second one. Now, so there's all this friction, and Rachel wants to have a child. She's envious of her sister. And what happens when you have envy in a situation? Almost inevitably, you're going to have strife. Your envy create strife between individuals, so I'm sure there was strife between these two women. And it's interesting the solution that they came up with in order to resolve the problem. Chapter 30, it says, so she said, give me children or else I die, in verse 1. And then in verse 2 it says, and Jacob's anger was aroused against Rachel, and he said, am I in the place of God who has withheld from you the fruit of the womb? I mean, I'm giving it my best shot. But you're not getting pregnant. God's not blessing you. God controls this. And so what was her solution? She came up with the same solution that Abraham and Sarah came up with when they did not have a child. In verse 3 it says, so she said, here is my maid Bilhah. Go into her and she will bear a child on my knees that I also may have children by her. So this seems strange to us living in the 21st century, but living in that time, that this was not uncommon. It was a solution where it talks about that I shall bear a child on my knees. It would be her child. It would be Rachel's child, not Bilhah's child. And that's the way it worked in that time. So she gives her handmaid to Jacob, and so she has a child by this handmaid Bilhah. We saw that Abraham and Sarah had a child. They had a child, Ishmael. And how did that work out? We're still seeing the effects of that choice in our time. Rachel name the child? She named the child Dan. And she named the child Dan because she figured God had judged her situation and given her the child. From the birth of Dan, by the handmaid, she deduced that God had heard her complaint and judged her situation, giving her a son. And she felt a measure of blessing. And, she was quite envious and stressed out by not being able to have a child. And, as you think about this situation, you have already the friction between Leah and Rachel. Now you introduce the handmaid into this who has a child. Now, how many of you are going to have a child and carry that child for 9 months and let this other lady take over the care of the child and not have some affection for that child? That's not normal. That's not normal at all. Now, it may be, technically speaking, Rachel's child, but you're not going to have any affection between Bilhah and Dan. And you've just introduced another person and another child into this whole situation. But Rachel's pleased. And then verse 7, it says, "And Rachel's maid Bilhah conceived again and bore Jacob a second son." So, a second son, Naphtali, is born. And she's very pleased with that. As she says, she bore a second son. Then Rachel said, "With great wrestlings, I have wrestled with my sister, and indeed I have prevailed." So she called his name Naphtali. So she's admitting mentally and probably verbally. I don't know whether they fought each other, but there's conflict. There's envy. There's strife between these two women. And I'm sure Jacob spent a lot of time in the field to avoid having to deal with this conflict and strife, which would at times boil over. So we see there's these wrestlings that are going on in the mind of Rachel as a result of that. She's wrestling with her sister. And there's strife, there's envy, there's conflict between the women. And, Rachel felt if she could just have a child, she would be fulfilled as a woman. And as a wife. And as you look at these things, do you think it was impacting the children? Who do you think Dan and Naphtali are going to favor? Yeah, Rachel's your technical mother, but that really is your mother. And there's strife between these women, and you don't think the children noticed it? So, let's go down to chapter 30 and verse 9. So here Rachel has had two children by her handmaid. So what does Leah do? When Leah saw that she had stopped bearing, she took Zilpah, her maid, and gave her to Jacob as wife. Well, if you can do that, so can I. And Leah's handmaid Zilpah bore Jacob a son. Then Leah said, "A troop comes." So she called his name Gad. And Leah's maid Zilpah bore Jacob a second son. Then Leah said, "I am happy, for the daughters will call me blessed." So she called his name Asher. Gad and Asher. So we have, again, we have a tit for tat. And Zilpah had two boys, and Leah was happy. Leah was happy. And then we go on to verse 14. "Now Reuben went in the days of wheat harvest and found mandrakes in the field and brought them to his mother Leah." Now, what were mandrakes used for? Well, they were considered at that time a type of aphrodisiac. So he went and gathered these. Then Rachel said to Leah, "Please give me some of your son's mandrakes." So she's looking at this as an aphrodisiac, and hopefully she's hoping that maybe these will contribute to her becoming pregnant and having a child, that she would begin producing eggs and that God would open her womb. So she asked for the mandrakes. And in verse 15, "But she said to her," that is Leah said to her, Is it a small matter that you would have taken away my husband? You have my husband's heart. I was married to him for 7 years before you came into the household. Would you take away my son's mandrakes also? And Rachel said, therefore, he will lie with you tonight for your son's mandrakes. So what's happening here? Rachel says, okay, here's what we'll do. You give me the mandrakes, and I'll give you Jacob. You'll be able to sleep with Jacob tonight. Now, that's what you want going on in your household? But this is the level of strife and conflict that's taking place here in the house. And Jacob's out in the field, and he comes in. It says, when Jacob came out of the field in the evening, Leah went out to meet him and said, you must come in to me, for I have surely hired you with my son's mandrakes. And he lay with her that night. And Jacob seemed like, hey, that's okay with me. That's okay with me. But you can see you've got a lot of difficulty here in this family. And as a result of Jacob lying with her, another child she conceived and bore Jacob a fifth son, and his name was Issachar. His name was Issachar. And then in verse 19, we see a sixth son born, and his name was Zebulun. And let's go to verse 20. And Leah said, God has endowed me with a good endowment. Now my husband will dwell with me because I have borne him six sons. So she called his name Zebulun. But did it change Jacob's approach? Did it change his heart toward her? Sadly, it did not. So God kept blessing Leah until in verse 23, Rachel finally conceives and Joseph is born. And let's go back up to verse 31, chapter 29, verse 31. And he said, what shall I give you? And Jacob said, you shall not give me anything. If you will do this thing for me, I will again feed and keep your flocks. So I think I'm in the wrong chapter 29, verse 31. That's what I wanted. Back to chapter 29, verse 31. It says, when the Lord saw that Leah was unloved, he opened her womb, but Rachel was barren. So that changed. Then God remembered Rachel, as it tells us in chapter 30, verse 22. Chapter 30, verse 22, it says, then God remembered Rachel, and he opened her womb. And she had Joseph. She had Joseph. He opened her womb, and she was able to bear a son. And this was a very important thing. Finally, she had a son of her own. Now, as you look at all of this taking place, you have to realize that God's involved here. And God has an overall purpose in mind, which just looking at all of the conflict and envy and strife that's going on here, we miss that God is actually working out something that they had no clue about. And the Apostle Paul talks about it in Romans chapter 9. God is working out something here because God is able to work things out. He's able to see the end from the beginning and to work it out in the way that He wants it to be worked out for His ultimate purpose to be achieved. Romans chapter 9. Let's begin in verse 10. God's looking down the road to the nations that would come and would be His representatives on the earth. And He's working in the lives of the people that we see here in Genesis chapter 29 and 30, because He's taking major steps to form the nations into which He's going to enter covenant. Romans chapter 9, verse 10. Romans chapter 9, verse 10. For the children, not yet being born, and not only this, but when Rebekah also had conceived by one man, even by our father Isaac, for the children not yet being born, nor having done any good or evil, that the purpose of God according to election might stand, not of works, but of Him who calls. You see, God was going to work with Jacob's descendants, not Esau's. it's a matter of time. He eventually will work with Esau's descendants, but God was going to work with the descendants of Jacob first. And it's God who makes that judgment. It is God who makes that call. And it's the way that he's working out his plan. Verse 12, it was said to her, the older shall serve the younger. That's Esau's going to serve Jacob. As it is written, Jacob I have loved, but Esau I have hated. Now, God didn't hate Esau, but he loved Jacob more. He preferred Jacob at that time to accomplish his purpose. Verse 14, what shall we say then? Is there unrighteousness with God? Is God unrighteousness in this? Unrighteous in this? He's not. For he says to... So God chose to do things in his particular way. And the question is asked here, was God wrong in doing things the way that he did? Was he wrong in that he blessed Leah with so abundantly with the children that he did? Was he wrong in withholding children from Rachel? Was he wrong in giving sons to Jacob through the two handmaids? God allowed this, and he allowed it for his purpose. Is that exactly how it would have been worked out? That's what they chose to do, and God chose to work with the situation as it unfolded. Romans chapter 9, verse 15. He says to Moses, I will have mercy on whomever I will have mercy, and I will have compassion on whomever I will have compassion. So then it is not of him who wills, nor of him who runs, but of God who shows mercy. So we see here that, God wills. And it's not based upon how you run necessarily. And we'll reflect on this here in a moment. So it says in that talks about Pharaoh and that God raised him up for his purpose. Verse 18, it's whom he wills. And then, so we see here that as you look at chapters 29 and 30, and look at what took place with Jacob, Leah, Rachel, and the two concubines in the household, did any of these people deserve to be called? As you look at what transpired here, what unfolded here, which of these people deserved to be called according to God's purpose? In what way had they earned it? And that's something to keep in mind. Their selection by God was an act of sheer grace. It was totally and completely undeserved. And were these people sinful? Absolutely. I mean, when you've got envy, strife, contention, outdoing each other, competition for the love of someone, you're going to have problems. And they had problems and there was sin. And God's calling of Jacob was not conditioned upon either the moral merits of Jacob or Rachel or Leah or Zilpah or Bilhah. And we could just keep going right on back where of Isaac himself were the moral failures of Esau. These people, even as today, had to meet the circumstances of life with their knowledge of God. And their knowledge of God was, as you can see, what's taking place here was pretty limited. I mean, if we were looking at the situation here and saying, are these people Christians? You'd say, these people don't get it at all. Isn't that what we would conclude? I mean, if you saw this going on in the church, you'd say, are these people Christians? I don't think so. So this isn't the example to follow, but it shows you that they didn't deserve God's working with them. They didn't deserve it at all. And as you look at Jacob, I think Jacob became a converted man. But at this point, with all of this going on in his household, he was not converted. He became a converted man. I think he had to go through these things and learn these lessons, to have been cheated by Laban, and go through all of the trials and difficulties that he went through in his life in order to learn the lessons that allowed him to come back to the land of promise and wrestle with the one we know as Jesus Christ. And to be persistent in doing so. He became a converted man, and that's something we'll talk about in the future. So I think what the Bible records of Rachel and Leah shows that Although Rachel was better physically endowed, she was beautiful. But Leah was the one who had the better character. So that kind of gives us an idea of what was going on in the household. But let's go to Genesis chapter 34 and look at another situation that took place that gives us some insight into the character of the sons of Jacob. Genesis chapter 34, and let's begin in verse 1. This is speaking of the sister of the sons of Jacob, and her name was Dinah. It says, "Now Dinah, the daughter of Leah, whom she had borne to Jacob, went out to see the daughters of the land." So she went out. They were living in the land of Canaan. They were living near a place called Shechem, and she went out to see the daughters of the land. "And when Shechem, the son of Hamor the Hivite, prince of the country, saw her, he took her and lay with her and violated her." You know, put in more graphic language, he raped her. But even though he raped her, it says that his soul was strongly attracted to Dinah, the daughter of Jacob, and he loved the young woman and spoke kindly to the young woman. So Shechem spoke to his father, Hamor, saying, "Give me this young woman as a wife." So, this Dinah made some mistakes and got herself into trouble, but the person she got into trouble with did want to marry her. And, as we see this tragedy unfold, we see the personalities and attitudes and character of the brothers of Joseph. And as you look at Shechem's proposal to, he was dishonorable in what he did, but he seemed to love her and want her as a wife. And considering that this man was a Gentile, he had no knowledge of the true God, he wanted to do something that does fit biblically. If this kind of act had taken place in Israel, then you were bound to marry that person. So he wanted to marry her. And what happened was Jacob and Hamor, they became aware of it and they were going to negotiate how this would work out. However, that's not what took place. So it says in verse, let's go down to verse 7 here. It says, "And the sons of Jacob came in from the field when they heard it, and the men were grieved and very angry because he had done a disgraceful thing in Israel by lying with Jacob's daughter, a thing that ought not to be done. But Hamor spoke with them, saying, 'The soul of my son Shechem longs for your daughter. Please give her to him as a wife and make marriages with us. Give your daughters to us and take our daughters to yourselves. So you shall dwell with us and the land shall be before you.'" So they say, well, all right. He goes on to say here in verse 12, "And ask me ever so much dowry and gift, and I will give according to what you say to me, but give me the young woman as wife. But the sons of Jacob answered Shechem and Hamor his father and spoke deceitfully." So this tells us something about Dinah's brothers and Joseph's brothers. They spoke deceitfully because he had defiled Dinah, their sister. So they felt that they were justified in being deceitful because of what had transpired with their sister. "But the sons of Jacob answered Shechem and Hamor, and they said to them, 'We cannot do this thing to give our sister to one who is uncircumcised, for that would be a reproach to us.'" So, she can't marry somebody that's uncircumcised. "But on this condition, we will consent to you. If you will become as we are, if every male of you is circumcised, then we will give our daughters to you, and we will take your daughters to us, and we will dwell with you, and we will become one people." So you need to be circumcised. And remember, they're speaking deceitfully. So they said, "Fine, that's great. We'll meet that condition. We'll have every male in the community here circumcised." And they did. And as is common with circumcision, you're usually sore after going through the process, which they were. So they waited till they knew that they were good and sore. And what they did is they went through the community and they killed every male. Simeon and Levi killed every male in the community. So they didn't wait for negotiations to take place. They took the matter into their own hands. The Simeon and Levi killed all the males, as it says in verse 25. And then we see something else interesting here in chapter 34, verse 26. And they killed Hamor and Shechem, his son, with the edge of the sword, and took Dinah from Shechem's house and went out. Then the sons of Jacob. So Simeon and Levi are involved, but now we find the other sons becoming involved in what's taking place here. And they came upon the slain and plundered the city because their sister had been defiled. They took their sheep, their oxen, their donkeys, what was in the city and what was in the field, and all their wealth, all their little ones, their wives, they took captive, and they plundered even all that was in the house. And then, so they plundered. All the brothers joined in with this, in this process. So what kind of character did these sons have? And so Jacob becomes aware of this, verse chapter 34, verse 27. They plundered the city, and then we see here in verse 30, "Then Jacob said to Simeon and Levi, 'You have troubled me by making me obnoxious among the inhabitants of the land, among the Canaanites and the Perizzites, and since I am few in number, they will gather themselves together against me and kill me. I shall be destroyed, my household and I.'" So Jacob says, you didn't even allow the negotiations to go forward. You've allowed this to take place and killed all these people. And now the Canaanites, what are they going to do? They're going to rise up and wipe us out. And they should have, because they were much more numerous than Jacob. But God was merciful to them, and so God intervened and did protect them. But the response of the brothers to Jacob is this in verse 31. They justify their action. Should he treat our sister like a harlot? So we are given here a bit of insight into the qualities that are found among the Jacob's sons. And let's go to keep your place there and just turn over to Genesis chapter 49, where it talks about Simeon and Levi. Genesis chapter 49, verses 5 through 7. It says here in verse 5, "Simeon and Levi are brothers, instruments of cruelty are in their dwelling place. Let not my soul enter their council, let not my honor be united to their assembly, for in their anger they slew a man, and in their self-will they hamstrung an ox. Cursed be their anger, for it is fierce, and their wrath, for it is cruel, and I will divide them in Jacob and scatter them in Israel." So they were, you know, given their own land, but in time they were scattered in Israel, not having their own territory. So they were denied some of God's blessings as a result. And Jacob may have forgiven them, but he never forgot what they did. Just as Jacob may have forgiven Reuben for his actions, but he didn't forget about that either. So I bring the incident here with Dinah up because it gives us some ideas about the attitudes and the actions that were found in the brothers of Joseph. A mother, we find here that a mother who gives every indication of being a beautiful but vain whiner, accustomed to having her own way. And because of her beauty, she had charm. And a father who was not only deceitful, but was a person who was very energetic in his spirit and had strong convictions, which are good, and he was very focused at times, but that can also be a problem. So Joseph had brothers who could not help but be affected by an almost constant stream of competitive attitudes flowing back and forth. That's the family he came into. That's what he grew up in. That's what he saw. And the Bible doesn't tell us much about Bilhah and Zilpah, but what do you think about them? If you were in their condition and you went through what they went through, how would you feel in the family? As you think about Jacob and Rachel, you know, was their love one that lasted a lifetime? Or was it just something that came on in their early years and died out? Was it something that didn't last? Well, let's think about this here for a few minutes as we get near the end of the sermon. It seems that both Jacob and Rachel loved each other, and that love lasted for a lifetime. Now, how can we know that? We might consider a flaming passion when they were young, but did it last? Let's look at a few things. As best we can determine, Isaac was born when Abraham was either 100 or in his 100th year. Isaac married Rebekah. Then Jacob and Esau were born when Isaac was 60. And the Bible tells us that Esau married when Isaac was 100. Esau was 40 at that time. And this next scripture took place at the time that Isaac was deceived into pronouncing the blessing upon Jacob. Let's go to chapter 27 of Genesis and look at verses 1 and 2. Genesis 27, verses 1 and 2. It says, "Now it came to pass, when Isaac was old and his eyes were so dim that he could not see, that he called Esau, his older son, and said to him, 'My son.' And he answered him, 'Here I am.' Then he said, 'Behold, now I am old. I do not know the day of my death.'" Believe it or not, Isaac's talking like he's going to die any moment. But you know what? He had 40 years to live. He had 40 years of life ahead of him. Now, he was old enough that his eyes were quite dim, where he couldn't recognize by sight Jacob and Esau. But he went on to live to be 180. And I give you these figures so that you'll understand that these people were pretty old by today's standards when these things are playing out. What about Jacob's age? Well, we can do a little bit of calculating. Let's go to chapter 41 and look at verse 46. Genesis chapter 41, verse 46. Here it says, "Joseph was 30 years old when he stood before Pharaoh, king of Egypt. And Joseph went out from the presence of Pharaoh and went throughout all the land of Egypt." So he's 30 at this point. He's 30 at this point. As you go on in chapter 41 down to verses 53 and 54, it says, "Then the 7 years of plenty which were in the land ended." So 7 more years have gone on. "And the 7 years of famine began to come, as Joseph had said. The famine was in all lands, but in all the lands of Egypt there was bread." So we have 7 years of plenty were ended. And at that time, Joseph would have been 37. And then it says in in chapter 45, verse 6, it says in verse 6, "For these 2 years the famine has been in the land, and there are still 5 years in which there will be neither plowing nor harvesting." So 2 more years go on, so Joseph's going to be 39. And then we go to chapter 47 and look at verse 9. Genesis chapter 47 and look at verse 9. "And Jacob said to Pharaoh, 'The days of the years of my pilgrimage are now 130 years.'" So at this point, Jacob is in Egypt and he's 130 years old. And he says, "Few and evil have been the days of the years of my life. And they have not attained to the days of the years of the life of my fathers in the days of their pilgrimage." So he said that his life was hard. And we can think back to Isaac. He was 180. Abraham was 175 when he died. And here's Jacob at 130, and he felt like an old man. And in chapter 47, let's look at verses 27 and 28. Genesis 47, verses 27 and 28. "So Israel, that is Jacob, dwelt in the land of Egypt in the country of Goshen, and they had possessions there, and grew and multiplied exceedingly. And Jacob lived in the land 17 years. So the length of Jacob's life was 147 years. So he lived for another 17 years in the land of of Egypt. So the whole length of Jacob's life was 140 years. So how old was Joseph by this time then? Well, by this time, Joseph was either 39 or 40. And since Jacob was 130 when he went into Egypt, and Joseph was 39 or 40 at the time that Jacob came into Egypt, we subtract 39 or 40 from 130, Joseph was born when Jacob was either 90 or 91. So Joseph was born when he was 90 or 91. He was just a passionate teenager at that time. So there's been a lot of time that's passed here. And since Joseph appears to have been the 11th in line and Benjamin the 12th, you know, the other 10 could have been born in a relatively short span, but they weren't spring chickens when all of this unfolded. So we know that Jacob had to work 7 years for Laban in order to secure Rachel, and he had to work another 7 years before he was actually given Rachel. He had Leah first. So he didn't start young. And I think given Jacob's age and his maturity and so forth, his expressed love for Rachel was real, and it lasted a lifetime. And it was a shame for Leah, what she had to endure, the way that things worked out, where, you know, Jacob did not love her like he did Rachel. And Leah was jealous the whole time. But it's interesting, I think that Jacob would have loved, it would have been worse if Leah had not had any children. If Rachel had had the children, it would have made life tougher. But God was working with Jacob, and, you know, Jacob was a deceiver, and when he went to live in Laban's household, his uncle's household, what did he do? He deceived him, just as he had deceived his father Isaac. And Rachel was supplanted by Leah, you know, setting up a very painful penalty that Jacob had to endure throughout his life. So Rachel went on to have another child, a second child by the name of Benjamin. She named it Benoni, but Jacob changed it to Benjamin, and then Rachel died. And when Rachel died, this was a defining moment in the life of Joseph. And he's not mentioned in the death of Rachel, but I think it was a defining moment for him, because I'm sure that Jacob, who loved Rachel to the end, and had lavished his love on Rachel, to whom do you think that he then lavished his love after Rachel's death? It was upon Joseph. Joseph transferred his affection to Jacob transferred his affection to Joseph, and much to the envy of the rest of the family. So we find in Genesis chapter 37, verse 3, it says, "Now Israel loved Joseph more than all his children, because he was the son of his old age. Also he made him a tunic of many colors." He loved him, and he has other kids, and he loved Rachel, and he had another wife. And he didn't learn his lesson in that experience, that maybe favoring one over the other isn't a good idea. But that's what Jacob did. Now the story begins with Jacob making this very serious child-rearing problem. And it was he had a mind that was geared that way. And we've not talked much about Jacob's character up to this point, but what the Bible reveals are some pretty seamy sides of Jacob. You know, he was not a perfect man by any means. He was selfish, he was a schemer, an opportunist. And one author called him the biblical version of Dr. Jekyll and Mr. Hyde. He neither had the faith of Abraham nor the purity of Joseph. Yet he was undoubtedly a person who grew and matured and is eventually going to be a part of God's kingdom. But you know, as you think about this and you think about why, with Jacob's favor, how did this work out positively for Joseph? You may think, man, what a bad move. This caused all kinds of problems in the family. And it did go on to do that. But it did work well for Joseph. And here's why. By the time that Jacob was returning to the land of Canaan, after his 20-year exile in Syria, he was beginning to get things right. He had learned some lessons. Not all of them by any means, but he had learned a number of spiritual lessons. And when Rachel died on the way back, Joseph became the beneficiary of the wisdom that Jacob had gleaned from a tumultuous lifetime of experiences. Jacob had been through a lot, and he had learned a lot, so he was able to pass that along to Joseph. Then he began to spend time, what we would call today quality time, to pass these things along to Joseph, to give him attention, to give him time, to pass on his wisdom, things that he had not given to his other sons. So should we be surprised, we see Simeon and Levi taking vengeance because they had not been taught. So, interestingly, as I've said, Isaac was probably alive when Jacob came back to the land of Canaan. And this allowed Joseph to spend some time with his grandfather, who was a righteous man, who was known for the fear of God. And you don't think that he spent time with his grandfather and learned certain lessons from him as well? So I think that Jacob took the time to pass along the lessons he had learned to Joseph. And I think that Isaac contributed to that as well, to help Joseph to come to understand some important things about God's way of life. So as we look at Joseph, we're looking at an individual that is important for us to understand more about. A man who seems to have been blessed with a great deal of integrity and spiritual purity. And then a few weeks, we will have a guest speaker next week, and then we'll have the San Antonio weekend. In a few weeks, we'll come back to Joseph, and we'll learn more about his life.